Heavy industrial activity and the agricultural use of chemical fertilizers have become more common, so has a rather unique form of water pollution, nutrient pollution. Both agricultural and industrial processes release plant nutrients into the air, soil, and water. Eventually, the nutrients in the air and soil can dissolve into aquifers, streams, lakes, rivers, and the oceans. When combined with the natural and human-made nutrients already in a marine environment, these excess nutrients result in soaring amounts of algae in the water. These algae are allowed to reproduce so voraciously because the natural limits on the algae's population size has been removed due to the copious amounts of nutrients polluting the body of water. These algal blooms are only the beginning of water problems caused by nutrient pollution. KBSC News recently had an opportunity to speak about nutrient pollution with Don Bosch, a professor of marine science and the president of the Center for Environmental Science at the University of Maryland. First off, what are the effects of too many nutrients in the water?
Well, excessive amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus, these are nutrients that you might add to your garden, for example, to make plants grow, washing off from the land or injected into waters by waste discharges, enter aquatic systems, fresh waters, lakes, rivers, and streams, but also, importantly, the coastal waters of around the world. And the nutrient levels that have been added to them have increased dramatically over the last 50 years or so. And what's happened is that nutrients in coastal waters, just like in your garden, makes plants grow. And so the plants that it makes grow are these microscopic algae that live in the water, and they can grow to high densities, which do a number of things. One, that can shade, prevent the light from penetrating so that other grasses and so that grow underwater are eliminated. These plants, these microscopic plants, also when they die, they settle down to the bottom and decompose, and then they can deplete the oxygen levels in the water, which are necessary for fish and shellfish and the like. And some of these algal blooms, as they're called, can be actually species that are toxic and can produce toxins that kill shellfish and even in some cases cause human health problems.
As far as the controlling methodologies, I know that near St. Cloud, a food processing plant on a local river had to put a phosphorus removal system on its water discharge pipes to help clean up the river. But other than regulating industry and, to a certain extent, agriculture, concerning the amount of fertilizers put on crops, which I'm not even sure is feasible, how can we achieve these reductions of these nutrients in the water?
Well, it takes a multi-pronged approach. First of all, the example you presented with respect to the factory and phosphorus, freshwater systems, for example, the Great Lakes or lakes in Minnesota, for that matter, have long been known to have suffer these nutrient over-enrichment problems. And in freshwaters, for the most case, there are exceptions, phosphorus is the limiting nutrient. So it was a matter of then trying to control the phosphorus levels. And so we did things like improve the waste treatment. And phosphorus is relatively easy to control in wastewaters. We've eliminated the use of phosphate-based detergents, so there isn't as much phosphorus coming into sewage treatment plants and other waste streams. And that's, for example, had a dramatic effect on improving water quality in the Great Lakes, for example. The problems with respect to the marine environment downstream as these rivers enter the ocean is that nitrogen tends to be the more limiting nutrient. And so it's necessary then to control nitrogen as well as phosphorus. Nitrogen is more challenging because it comes from a large number of sources. It comes from the same waste, whether they're industrial waste or whether they're human waste in sewage treatment plants. As those wastes are treated to, you know, remove the other pollutants, the nitrogen and phosphorus, the nutrients, are left over. in most of the conventional waste treatment technologies. So in areas where nutrient pollution is a serious problem, or particularly nitrogen pollution, for example, here in the Chesapeake Bay region where I work, they're now have introduced new technologies to biologically remove nitrogen from the waste streams in sewage treatment plants. So that's already been successful in reducing the nitrogen and phosphorus loadings into the Chesapeake Bay. The second major source of nutrients that you refer to is agriculture. Of course, we use both nitrogen and phosphorus as fertilizers in agricultural to grow crops. The majority of the crops actually go to feed animals, so the nitrogen and phosphorus is included in the animal waste that has to be dealt with. So in the whole agricultural cycle, there are a whole number of ways that we can think about conserving and reducing the losses of these nutrients. Part of it is being very smart about not applying too many nutrients, too much fertilizer. Often in agriculture, we've tended to err on the side of a little too much because the concerns about reduced yield and the like. There are new approaches that we can get closer to what the crops actually need and save the environment in terms of the nutrient pollution, but also save money in terms of the reduced cost of fertilizer. There are other practices, agricultural practices, that can trap the nutrients so they aren't lost from the farm field or don't go into groundwater. For example, here in the Chesapeake, we're using more and more in the fall planting cover crops. These crops hold the nitrogen levels near the soil surface and don't allow them to get into the groundwater. And there are many other approaches and technologies that we can use to more effectively handle, treat, manage, and apply animal waste. So that's agriculture. The third major source of nitrogen in particular is a surprising one to most people, and that's the atmosphere. It falls out of the air. And its primary source is the combustion of fossil fuels. So your automobile, power plants, and the like emit oxides of nitrogen by burning fossil fuels. Those then can rain back down on the landscape and on coastal waters and put nitrogen into that system. This is acid rain, one of the causes of acid rain, for example, that you might be familiar with. The other, of course, environmental concern that we have with those nitrogen oxide emissions is that nitrogen oxide causes ozone formation. It degrades the air quality, and particularly in urban areas. And so this is an effort, major efforts have been underway for clean air to reduce the emissions of nitrous oxides, both from automobiles as well as power plants. So there are major efforts, again, underway that are going to reduce those emissions even further. So it really takes a three-pronged approach. One is treating our waste, both municipal and industrial waste more effectively, managing agricultural affairs much more efficiently with respect to nutrient losses, and then third, improving air quality and thereby gaining some benefits in improved water quality.
I wanted to ask about the time lag between taking measures to lower these nutrient pollutants and the actual point in time at which the marine biomes actually recover from the excessive nutrients. Does this recovery time vary region by region, or is it something more uniform?
No, I think it would vary, and it depends on the size of the ecosystem, if you will, and it also in the lags, the delays that are included in it, and then also how effectively we can ratchet down or reduce the sources. So it would range from some coastal environments. For example, a case in point is Sarasota Bay in Florida, where the primary source of nutrient pollution was waste treatment, with sewage discharges. And so when they implemented advanced waste treatment and reduced the inputs of nitrogen and phosphorus from the sewage treatment plants, within a very short time, a matter of a few years, they found the seagrasses returning, water clarity improving, these sorts of things. In larger systems, say, for example, where you folks sit in Minnesota at the headwaters of the Mississippi, it's going to be a longer process, first of all, because there are many more sources that have to be controlled. It's not just one waste treatment facility, but also because there's various lags within the system. Nitrogen builds up in groundwater and that in the groundwater may take some time, maybe even years, before it comes out into surface water and then comes down to the Gulf of Mexico. The best experiment that we have, unwitting experiment that we have about the delays, happened in Europe, in Eastern Europe, where with the collapse of the centralized Soviet economy in the Eastern Bloc states, within a matter of a short period, back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, the use of fertilizers, it was reduced in half in a matter of 2 years. And scientists there were able then to track the changes in the concentrations of the nutrients in the Danube River as they flowed to the Black Sea, which has, by the way, a similar dead zone problem as occurs at the Mississippi River, this large area of low oxygen, low or no oxygen on the bottom in the shelf waters of the Black Sea, as it is in the Gulf of Mexico. And so in that case, the lag, if you will, from when the reductions took place to when they actually saw the concentrations fall off and the oxygen levels in the Black Sea improve was about 7 years. Now, that's a rather dramatic experiment where you can change things fairly quickly. In reality, where we're working in places like the Chesapeake Bay, which are also large, have multiple sources, it's a much longer process because we have to work sort of incrementally at all the sewage treatment plants, at all the varieties of agriculture, and then also whatever we can accomplish with respect to the reduction of nutrient deposition from the atmosphere. We here in the Chesapeake region get a lot of those nutrients, nitrogen, imported from the Ohio Valley, for example, the power plants in the Ohio Valley, the emissions there. So that's only going to be dealt with respect to the new round of clean air regulations that's going to require a reduction of those sources.
Do you feel there are going to be any legislative or governmental impediments to these new regulations being put into effect?
Well, I think time will tell. I think on one hand, there were a number of on the clean air front, where there were a number of regulations that were put into place, and a court decision made right at the end of the Clinton administration, and right after Administrator Christy Whitman became Administrator of EPA, you may remember that there was a question about whether they would roll back those requirements on power plants so intended to improve East Coast air quality, and she said, no, we're not going to. So that's a hopeful sign. I think the other big change, though, of course, is the new attention that energy policy is been being given. On one hand, there's a need to meet the nation's energy supply. So we're talking about the greater number of power plants that have to be built, exploring and developing more fossil fuels, which are going to, of course, potentially increase the emissions into the atmosphere. On the other hand, there's this now, I think, growing realization that we have a serious problem in terms of the global environment with respect to the buildup of CO2. And even though we now have pressing energy requirements, we also know that we can't go on forever increasing the CO2 emissions, and so that now there's a discussion about greater efficiencies of using energy, and I think that if it's done right, could actually pay some benefits for air quality as well as this atmospheric deposition of nutrients.
Do you feel that proper management of nutrient pollution, seeing how this issue is connected to so many others, will require a concomitant bottom-up, top-down approach spanning the personal, local, nation-state, regional, and global arenas, not only from what a local farmer puts on their field, but to perhaps a United Nations program to deal with problems of nutrient pollution around the globe?
It's an interesting question. I think the nitrogen pollution problem, for example, is now increasingly recognized as a global-scale problem, much like CO2 and climate change is. The difference is, of course, is that the impacts of nitrogen pollution are sort of on continental scales. We're not changing the global atmosphere as a result of it in an important way. So I think it's primarily going to be met within nations or within groups of nations with share the same water bodies and resources. So we see things like starting back in the 70s in the early 80s here in the Chesapeake, where the three states, the three primary states, Virginia, Maryland, and Virginia, and the District of Columbia, have banded together and made some commitments on that regional scale. We have similar developments now taking place in the Mississippi Basin, where the upriver agricultural states primarily, because most of the nutrients coming down the Mississippi, the vast majority are from agricultural sources, are banding together to determine what kind of goals can be set and then how to reach them. So I think, you know, sort of continental scale rather than global scale is the way these things are going. Similar things are taking place in other parts of the world, the Baltic, the various nations around the Baltic Sea, which has serious nutrient pollution problems, have made commitments and are working together to do this. Black Sea, the nations of Eastern Europe, so it's going to be on that scale, I think, primarily rather than national treaties or national truly global or international programs.
Have these regional initiatives been successful in achieving the goals that they've set?
I would characterize it by there's been progress, but the progress has been difficult and generally slow, particularly for large systems, because you're dealing with so many sources in so many different states and nations. Here in the Chesapeake, for example, we think we've been successful. You know, we were on an upward trend in terms of, say, nitrogen pollution. It was the loadings were increasing every year, and that we made commitments and was signed off by the governors of the states in 1987, to be precise, to reduce those inputs by 40%. We haven't made the 40%, but we've probably come close to, say, 20% or something like that. So on one hand, you can look at it, well, we didn't get there, we failed. On the other hand, the trend that was increasing has been reversed, and so now the nitrogen coming into the Chesapeake is decreasing. And we've dealt with that primarily from dealing with the things that are centralized and we can put money into and manage technologically, like waste treatment facilities. The things that are more difficult are the things that, as you said, that are more bottom-up, that affect the actions, require actions that the individual farmer might make, or even the householder might make with respect to, you know, use of fertilizers on lawn care and decisions that we make in terms of how we live, dealing with continued sprawl development, you know, which is actually very has a very negative effect on nutrient pollution, or at least increases nutrient pollution, rather than managing that development, future development, in a more contained way. Those are the kinds of things that are going to require the public to understand this and sort of take personal responsibility.
Lastly, where could people obtain more information about things like nutrient pollution?
Well, there are a number of places. I, for example, did a report for the Pew Oceans Commission, which is dealing with a variety of problems of the oceans around the United States, and that report is on the available from the commission and on the web. Their website is simply www.pewoceans.org. That's PEWOCEANS, one word, org. And in addition to that, if you're interested in a particular region of the country that's working on this issue fast and furiously in a multi-pronged attack, I'd point your listeners to the Chesapeake Bay Program. And that much information is available over the web, again, at www.chesapeakebay.net. And you'll find a lot of information about nutrient pollution generally, but also how we're trying to manage and reduce it here in the Chesapeake region.
The previous interview was with Don Bosch, a professor of marine science and the president of the Center for Environmental Science at the University of Maryland. The background is by the Antibalas Afrobeat Orchestra from their album Liberation Afrobeat Volume 1. The track is Nesta. That's it for this program. Reporting for KVSC News, I'm Jed Cousin.